Well, this evening is one of the occasional times when we don't have a proper worship service on a Sunday evening. We simply invite friends along who maybe have not come to our church before for a talk about some issue of general interest regarding the Christian faith. We hope it'll be of interest whether or not you regard yourself as a Christian or not at the present time. And the subject we've chosen for tonight is the subject of miracles and the empty tomb. Let me begin with a little analogy, if you like. George is 8 years old. George has an invisible friend called Dan. Dan Dare, to be precise. He found Dan Dare in an old comic he read. He talks to his friend Dan. They have great adventures together. If you ask George, he can tell you an awful lot about Dan Dare, for he feels he knows him very well. But of course, if you press him on the point, George will admit that Dan's not real. He's a pretend friend, as George would say. A childhood fantasy, as we might say. A projection of George's imagination. Georgina is 18 years old. She has an invisible friend too. She calls him Jesus. Jesus Christ, to be precise. She found him in a book she read too. And like George, she talks to her friend and they have great adventures together. If you ask her, Georgina will tell you she feels she knows an awful lot about Jesus, that she knows him very well. The only difference between her and George is that she insists her invisible friend is real. If you press her on the point, she insists Jesus is not a fantasy, a creation of her imagination. Indeed, she would say it would be closer to the truth to say that she was a creation of his imagination. Who's right? Is she right? Or is she a victim of delusion? Now, there are some people who would say it doesn't really matter if Georgina is deluded. So long as her religious faith enriches her experience, they would say, then it should be affirmed positively. One thinks in that connection of Peter Schaeffer's play, Equus, in which a teenaged boy becomes very attached to the symbol of Jesus, an icon of Jesus, on a picture in his bedroom wall. His atheistic father is very annoyed about this, and tries to put an end to his son's superstition, as he sees it. He substitutes the icon of Jesus, takes it away, and substitutes for it a picture of a horse, hence the title of the play, Equus. Whereupon the boy, rather perversely, becomes infatuated with the horse instead. In desperation, the father sends his son to a psychiatrist to see if the psychiatrist can rid the boy of this equine fixation. But instead, the interesting thing about the play is that the psychiatrist discovers he actually envies the boy. He envies the boy's spiritual experience, which he enjoys in relationship to this horse, this obsession. He can see what joy his worship of horses injects into the young man's life. And he reasons, how could I rob a patient of something which has so deepened his human experience? So the lesson, I suppose, to be drawn from that quite famous play and film, Equus, is that whatever you worship, be it horses or Jesus, religion is good psychotherapy, so don't knock it. It should be affirmed. It does you good. Well, I don't know how you feel about that, but I confess I'm not at all satisfied with that sort of verdict. It matters to me whether Georgina is right or not about her friend Jesus. No doubt, for its own sake, a well-developed imagination is enormously enriching. But it's surely the mark of insanity when a person can't distinguish fantasy from reality. No doubt we all are inclined to build our castles in the air sometimes, but only the psychotic tries to live in them. In the days before I became a Christian, I was often annoyed by the way that Christians really didn't seem to distinguish this matter very carefully. They often seemed to present arguments in support of their faith, which were frankly emotional. It makes you feel good. Therefore, it must be right. Therefore, it must be okay. There are lots of things that might make you feel good. That doesn't make them okay, does it? Perhaps it was because I was trained in the natural sciences, and I had this sort of strong conviction about the reality of the external world, therefore. For me, a religious faith could only be justified if it corresponded to objective reality out there. If all it was about was my inner feelings, if all it was about was warm fuzzies on the inside, then, frankly, it didn't really matter to me whether a person was a Hindu or a Muslim or a Christian or a humanist or whatever. A follower of Freud, follower of Jung, follower of Rogers. It was all much the same sort of stuff. No matter how comforting faith might be emotionally, if it didn't correspond to some objective external reality, then for me it was intellectually as acceptable or as unacceptable as believing in fairies at the bottom of the garden. I mean, believing in fairies at the bottom of the garden is a very nice thing to believe in. Can enrich your imagination, make you feel cozy and warm, perhaps. Now, that is still my view. It's still my view that if it doesn't correspond to reality, religious faith has nothing really to commend it beyond psychotherapy or anything else of that nature. What surprised me, I think, and actually in my case led eventually to my conversion to becoming a Christian, was the discovery that whilst some of my Christian friends didn't seem to see it that way, the Bible actually agreed with me. It agreed with me that unless it corresponded to objective reality, faith was a pretty futile thing. Look at these words, which come from the Apostle Paul in the New Testament, from his first letter, his first letter to the Corinthians, chapter 15. If it is preached that Christ has been raised from the dead, how can some of you say there is no resurrection from the dead? If there's no resurrection of the dead, then not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless. Notice that. And so is your faith. More than that, we are found to be false witnesses about God, for we have testified about God that he raised Christ from the dead. But he did not raise him if, in fact, the dead are not raised. For if the dead are not raised, then Christ has not been raised either. And notice again, if Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile, and you are still in your sins. Quite clearly from that passage, as far as Paul was concerned, only a really historically risen Jesus would do. Only a truly living Christ, a Christ about whom this miracle of the resurrection was true, could provide the kind of objective foundation for faith which would distinguish the Christian faith from mere fantasy, would distinguish Georgina's Jesus from George's Dan Dare. Paul, in writing those words, is confronting a situation which is in some ways not unlike our own. There were actually elements in the Christian church in the first century who questioned whether a belief in a historical, objective resurrection from the dead was either credible or necessary. Many first century Christians had a very strong Greek background. They had been brought up in the atmosphere of Plato's philosophy. And one of the ingredients of that philosophy was rather to be contemptuous of the body, to find the idea of spirit getting bound up in the body rather offensive or incongruous. The whole idea of corporal bodily resurrection was rather philosophically unacceptable to many, many people brought up in a Greek atmosphere. They regarded it as a rather scandalous proposition. So quite early on, ideas began to develop within the Greek-speaking churches that escaped from such scandal. Some Greeks who wanted to call themselves Christians, for instance, would speculate that Jesus never had a real physical body at all. It only looked as if he had one. He was actually some sort of ghost wandering around. Some kind of, a projection, like that thing on Quantum Leap, is it? Or whatever that, or Red Dwarf, or whatever it is, that fellow who's a holographic projection. They must have thought of Jesus in some way like that. They were called, or were later called, docetists. Jesus only seemed to have a body. Others speculated that the story of the resurrection was a myth. The Greeks had lots of myths, which they were very comfortable about. They had one, for instance, about a young corn god called Mithras, a young man, a youth, who dies and rises again. Well, that was all right. Everybody knew that was a myth. No one pretended Mithras actually lived, that he actually died and rose again physically. Everyone knew it was a story with a sort of spiritual, mythological significance. So some of them would have liked to have interpreted the story of Jesus and the resurrection in that kind of mythological framework. Something rather similar has happened in our century. The orthodoxy of many Christians today has been compromised by similar kinds of viewpoints. I suppose it all began, actually, a couple of hundred years ago with a theologian called Lessing, a German theologian. He rather shook the theological world by insisting that history was inadequate to demonstrate the truth of Christianity. He didn't like the idea at all that Christians should pin their faith to a historical event, because he reasoned, well, historians can examine the history, and maybe as a result of their historical criticism, they come up with a view that in fact it never happened. And what happens to Christianity then? It can't exist any longer. He couldn't believe that Christianity, something as noble and as beautiful as Christianity, could be vulnerable to historical criticism in that way. So he insisted that the real basis for Christianity was reason, not history. If you couldn't prove the doctrines of Christianity by reason, you shouldn't believe them. The trouble with that was, of course, that it tended to create a kind of Christianity which was very philosophical, very dry. It tended to create a form of Christianity in which the experiential dimension, the supernatural dynamic, had been programmed out, and all you were left with was a kind of set of moral platitudes which you could defend as reasonable. More recently, a lot of theologians grew dissatisfied with that for obvious reasons. And that was really the next twist of the story, because then came along a Danish theologian called Kierkegaard, and he said, no, it's not that Christianity shouldn't be based on history, it shouldn't be based on reason either. He insisted that the truth of Christianity was based on unreason, essentially. Faith, he says, is an affirmation of life or value in spite of the evidence, be it historical evidence or rational evidence. Faith is a leap in the dark. You don't believe because of anything. Faith is always a kind of grasping of something which you can't prove, which is essentially absurd, even. Real faith, he says, doesn't need the props of either historical evidence or rational demonstration. Faith is much more authentic without such props, he says. Faith is grasped by a kind of mystical direct intuition. And there have been many others in the so-called existentialist school who've followed that line since, who've dismissed not only history but reason also. In fact, some of them have taken up this phrase, myth, and used it as a tool for describing what they feel the story of Christianity is, particularly the story of the resurrection. It's a myth. Historical sort of objective reality of that story is irrelevant, they say. The important thing is what that story means to you. Christianity is really about the internal world of the human spirit. It eschews all talk about objective or absolute truth or a real external world that's out there, and talks rather about how Jesus meets us by faith in our hearts, in a kind of spiritual experience, an encounter. If you like, this is a form of docetism which goes much further than the early church did. The docetists of the first century refused to believe that God could enter human history as flesh and blood. But the docetists of the 20th century refused to tie their faith to a God who can enter history in any verifiable way at all. For them, history is an irrelevance. Christianity is reduced to a form of mysticism. Now, I simply want to say this evening that that sort of idea of what Christianity is about is a travesty of New Testament Christianity. As far as the Apostle Paul was concerned, only a living Jesus, one who was really and objectively and historically risen from the dead, would do. Christianity, for him, was about a Jesus who had risen from the dead before witnesses, as you see in our reading up there. Only such a faith could deliver Christianity from being just one of the many varieties of mystery cult or philosophy that cluttered the Hellenistic world. Paul could see as well as anybody that if all Christianity is a myth, then it's as good as any other myth. Its validity lies in the sort of warm fuzzies it can create in you, the kind of experiential dimension it can create in you. But it doesn't lie in any truth claim which enables you to distinguish it from any other religion or philosophy. But Paul didn't feel that way about Christianity. For him it was true. And it was true because it had been historically verified. He puts this very candidly to the neighbours of the Corinthians who lived in philosophical Athens when he was preaching to them. He says, God has appointed a day in which he will judge the world. And he's given assurance of that objective focus to history to which all things are moving. He's given assurance of that by raising Jesus Christ from the dead. Paul insists then that every human being must deal with the Christian message because history, the whole of history, is moving towards a focus, the day of judgment, which whether we feel it's coming or not, is neither here nor there. It's coming. And God has made it quite clear it's coming out there in the objective world, which will hit us, whether we like it or not, by putting another great focus of history down into the embedded into the very history, the objective history of the world. Jesus rose from the dead. I can be sure about the day of judgment to come, he says, because Jesus rose from the dead before many witnesses in real history. The one is linked to the other. God has given assurance of these things, proof of them, by raising Jesus from the dead. And it's in that same spirit that he can say here, if Jesus isn't raised, then our preaching is useless. If Jesus isn't raised, your faith is futile. The Christian message for Paul wasn't an attractive fairy tale, the validity of which lay in the imaginative experience it can excite in the believer. Christianity for him is about the real God breaking into the real world and summoning men and women to repentance in the face of a day of judgment to come. Why is it that people in our century, and in the last couple of centuries perhaps, have wanted to escape from such a view of the resurrection, wanted to deny it, find some way of interpreting Christianity which doesn't require them to believe in a real historical resurrection? Why have they been so keen to do that? Well, I suppose the reason Lessing and Kierkegaard and people like that were so keen to escape from a historical resurrection was because they had a fundamental problem about miracles in general. It's this supernatural dimension to Christianity which proved a stumbling block to many people in the last couple of centuries as science has made its advance. David Hume, the philosopher of the 18th century, was one of the first people to articulate this very clearly. In his book on the impossibility of Christianity, as he calls it, he says, it's impossible that a man should rise from the dead. But he says it is not impossible that many witnesses should be mistaken. You see the way that David Hume's mind works there. He says, when you look back at an event in history, whether you believe that event happened or not hinges crucially on the degree of probability you assign to it. If you think that such and such an event was very probable, and someone tells you it happened, then you don't need a huge amount of evidence to believe that it happened. If, on the other hand, you take the view that such and such an event was highly improbable, and someone tells you, but it happened, then you need a huge amount of evidence to convince you that it happened. And if you regard such and such a thing as impossible, then no amount of evidence is enough to convince you that it happened. Your assessment of the probability of an event is a crucial factor in whether you can believe it happened or not. And he said, well, now look at it. Resurrections are impossible. Dead men stay dead. Science knows this. In all the cases you can observe, when a man dies, he stays dead. So it's impossible that a person should rise from the dead, he says. Scientifically, it's impossible. The other alternative is that the witnesses were mistaken. Now, that isn't improbable. If somebody tells me there were so many witnesses and they were all mistaken, I find that's possible to believe, he says. So on the balance of probability, it's much more likely that the witnesses were mistaken than that a man rose from the dead. He's an outstandingly fine philosopher, and the argument is an immensely powerful one. It's been reiterated in all sorts of ways since. Because, of course, there is a problem about historical evidence. Events in history are one-offs. It's not like a scientific experiment that you can repeat and prove. It happened once, It can't happen again. How do you know what happened? Every historian has this problem. How do you know what really happened? Is it true to say all you really know is what other people say? That you have sort of interpretations of history, but you can never really have access to what really happened. Is that true? There are some who are that skeptical. I don't think any of us really believe that, do we? Most of us, I think, would, from a purely common sense view, agree that you don't have to actually do a scientific repeat experiment of something to gain sufficient faith to believe that something happened. Think about a court of law. A crime has been committed. You can't repeat the crime. You can't take a Doctor Who's time machine and go back and see what actually happened. And yet if we're going to take the view that we can't possibly form any conviction about what happened, you can never put anybody in prison. You can never try anybody for the crime. You have to say, well, we don't know whether we did it or not. All we've got are interpretations of the event. It's nonsense. All of us know, from sheer common sense, it is perfectly possible to form a conviction about what happened on the basis of eyewitness evidence. All the time in courts of law, such evidence is used to convict people of crimes. Well, that is all, really, the New Testament is insisting upon. Nobody is insisting it's possible to prove 100%, like a scientific experiment or like a mathematical theorem, Jesus rose from the dead. What the New Testament is insisting is that there is ample eyewitness evidence to this event, and it is sufficient to generate the conviction that is necessary for a person to put their faith in Jesus Christ. That's what Paul is claiming here. We testify, he says, that God raised Christ from the dead. If you were to read this whole chapter, you would find that Paul actually lists the number of people who actually witnessed Jesus risen from the dead, including the 12 apostles, and including many, many other witnesses who are not all named. This thing, he insists, happened in public. It was in the public domain. There were many people who saw it, and they all witnessed to it. They're not philosophers who dreamed up some theory. They're not mystics who've all had some kind of private revelation. They're ordinary men and women who saw something with their eyes, just like any other objective event, and bear testimony, bear witness to what they saw. So they present themselves to the world not as philosophers or as mystics, but as witnesses, eyewitnesses. That's the word that is consistently used throughout the New Testament. The resurrection, as far as the New Testament is concerned, is not a theory or an experience. It is a piece of news. What are we to say then to the scientist who says, but I can't believe in miracles? Who says, like David Hume, miracles are impossible. Any alternative explanation is preferable to the suggestion that a miracle has happened. What are we to say to that? I think we have to say a number of things. The first thing we have to say is that it is actually thoroughly unscientific to exclude a possibility on a priori grounds. That is, from the beginning to say, I'm not prepared to accept that possible explanation of what has happened. There's a story told, famous story, that comes from the university here in Cambridge of two lecturers in the university, one of whom was a Christian and the other was a non-Christian, and they were having a private argument about the resurrection and whether it could have happened or not, and about miracles in general, therefore. They went into the gents' room to wash their hands before dinner. And as they were washing their hands, in the basin of the unbeliever, there was a little spider. And as the water rose in the basin, this poor little spider made his appearance and had to climb higher and higher up the basin to escape the rising tide until he was trapped between the rising water and the overflow pipe. At any moment, the water would rise the other inch and he would be propelled down to whatever oblivion lies down overflow pipes. Well, these two dons watched this spectacle with detached, objective scientific interest for a while. But then the Christian believer picked the little spider up, carried him across the room, if it was a him, I don't know whether spiders even have sex, some of you will have to tell me the half of this, I'm sure, and put it down on the window outside. Then he said to his unbelieving friend, now, from the point of view of that spider, that was a miracle. No doubt we are to imagine that spider going back to his spider colony that night, telling them what had happened, and facing a sea of skeptical faces. You don't expect us to believe that, Spiders don't fly. Unless, of course, there was one little deviant religious spider in their colony who would say to him, you know what happened? A human being intervened in your life. Because spiders don't believe in human beings, generally speaking, you see. Only odd spiders believe in human beings. Most spiders are convinced the world is their world and human beings are a myth. So when a human being intervenes in spider existence, they call it a delusion, they call it imagination, they call it a mystical experience. What they can't agree is that a real miracle happened. Because they don't believe in human beings. They've excluded that category from their worldview, so that explanation of what happened is outlawed a priori from the start. In just the same way, you see, if we from the start say, I'm not prepared to believe in miracles, what we're really saying is, I don't believe in God. That's the actual content of my statement, I don't believe in miracles. The actual content is, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in a supernatural world beyond this one. And because I don't believe in God, I'm not prepared to give him the opportunity of proving the contrary. Miracles can't happen. I'm not going to allow that explanation as a possible one for any event, no matter how well attested. But I suggest to you that that is not a scientific point of view. That is a thoroughly prejudiced point of view. The whole point about real science is that it never disbelieves anything on principle in that way. Real science has constantly made progress by adopting an open mind to the evidence. One can think of a number of occasions in history where knowledge has leapt forward because a scientist has refused to accept the established kind of view and taken seriously what you might call an anomaly. 500 years ago, the received scientific view was that the sun went round the earth. The geocentric model of the universe, as it was called. It didn't quite fit in all kinds of ways the patterns which Ptolemy, the ancient Egyptian, had had to devise to explain the motions of the planets in particular. It was very complicated on this model. Very contrived and unsatisfactory. But that was what everybody believed. The earth was the center and the sun went around. And then that chap Galileo came along and looked through his telescope, which he just made, and he saw the moons of Jupiter. And blow me, the moons of Jupiter were going round the planet. Suddenly it occurred to him that maybe the earth went round the sun. And if you actually worked it out, things began to look a lot simpler when you modeled the universe that way. But still people weren't prepared to accept it, of course. The professors at the University of Padua refused to look down his telescope, refused to believe this new model. It was impossible. Now, Galileo, of course, is the founder of modern science precisely because he took this anomaly, as it was, and took it seriously. A more recent example, Pierre and Marie Curie, the discoverers of radioactivity. The received doctrine at the beginning of the 20th century was that atoms were indivisible. But there was this obstinate observation which they made as a result of their work on uranium ores, which did not fit this doctrine that atoms were indivisible. So they dared to think the unthinkable, that atoms could actually be broken, could actually be divided, could actually change from one atom into another. And eventually, of course, that revolution led to the whole discovery of nuclear physics. Science progresses by taking seriously the facts that don't fit with previous ideas. And if necessary, science is always willing to engage in what's technically called these days a paradigm shift. That is to rearrange all the facts in your mind so as to accommodate the anomalous fact, the awkward fact, the angular fact, which didn't fit the way the knowledge was organized before. I suggest to you exactly the same principle has to be applied to the resurrection of Jesus. It is nonsense to say it's unscientific to believe in miracles. It's nonsense to say resurrections are impossible. That kind of closed-minded attitude has nothing to do with science whatsoever. What you have to say instead is that if a resurrection happened, in the case of Jesus of Nazareth, it is a most amazing anomaly, a most remarkable, angular accident of history, unlike any other event in history. An absolute discontinuity in the way that human existence normally works. And if it is true, therefore, A, it must mean that Jesus Christ was very, very special, different in some fundamental way from every other human being who's ever lived. And B, it must imply that any worldview which says human beings die and stay dead and that's all there is to human existence is fundamentally wrong. We've got to reorganize the facts in our head about how we think about ourselves to accommodate the fact that under certain circumstances a human being can rise from the dead. And all that that might imply. And that, of course, is exactly what Christians say. They say that Jesus was an absolutely unique person, unlike any other human being who's ever existed, and that his resurrection from the dead is of such such importance, it demands that we rearrange our thinking. Christianity doesn't talk about a paradigm shift, but it does talk about repentance, a new mind. Let's play the scientist for a moment, then, and look at the evidence for this resurrection event, which we'll be celebrating, those of us who are Christians, in just a couple of weeks' time. What are the alternative explanations, the alternative hypotheses for this story of the resurrection? If you're interested in looking in that in detail, there's a little booklet on our bookstall, which you might like to take away with you tonight. It's called The Evidence for the Resurrection by Sir Norman Anderson. He lives, actually, in Cambridge here. And over the years since this has been written, a lot of people have been greatly helped by it, because Norman Anderson was trained basically as a lawyer. He writes with a lawyer's scientific approach to the evidence in this little booklet. But maybe I can summarize some of what he says and give you a taste of it by saying basically there are only two hypotheses that you can go for if you want to escape from saying the resurrection really happened the way Christians say it did. The first thing you can say is that the resurrection didn't happen, but the story was made up. The early church, the early Christians, made it up. At its most charitable, this is what those theologians argue, that say the resurrection is a kind of pious myth. It evolved out of the spiritual experience of the early Christians. Jesus was so real in their hearts, they couldn't really believe he died. So this mythological way of expressing their conviction of Jesus' importance developed. But, frankly, the facts, when you look at them, don't ring true to that hypothesis. All the historical evidence in the Gospels confirms that these Christians definitely believed something quite dramatic had physically happened on the third day after Jesus' execution. Something which turned the disciples from a bunch of dejected defeatists into a community of hope. A community who associated resurrection of Jesus not with Good Friday, not with Saturday, the traditional day of religion in the Jewish world, but for some unaccountable reason, with Sunday. Something happened that day, on Sunday, they said. Some completely novel change in their perspective happened, which turned them from this bunch of defeatists into people who were full of hope. It's very hard to understand why Sunday was so important to them if something really remarkable didn't happen to it. And what they say happened, again and again and again, is not we felt his presence, but we saw him, we touched him, we talked to him. Now I suggest to you that if you're faced with testimony like that, pious myth is simply not an appropriate category. It has to be a lie if they're making it up. I mean, if it didn't really happen, it's a lie, a conspiracy to deceive. Now some, of course, have been bold enough to argue that too. They say it was a hoax. It was a fraud perpetrated by these first century Christians on the public. But again, the facts don't really fit that hypothesis, because if it were a hoax, you would have thought for a start that at least the early Christians would have made sure their stories tallied. Whereas in fact, the resurrection narratives in the Gospel are notorious for their lack of easy harmonization. And what are we to make of the fact that so many of these early Christians faced martyrdom a few years downstream, faced it in the conviction they were going to live forever? If we're saying they made it all up, then they must have known they weren't going to live forever. They must have known they were dying for a lie. The other line of explanation, if you like, that some people have adopted to try to escape from a historical resurrection is to say, no, the resurrection never happened, but something else did happen which the disciples thought was a resurrection. Some have argued, for instance, that Jesus never really died. He revived in the tomb after seeming to die. Oh, frankly, that idea strains the limits of credulity beyond anything else, I think. Here's a man who has suffered a Roman scourging, who's suffered crucifixion, who's gone without food or water for 3 days, and now he is able to, without the slightest hint of infirmity, present himself to his disciples as a credible portrayal as the Lord of life. I think that's too ridiculous for words, really. A second sort of theory is that the disciples saw some kind of apparition, either an imaginary person, a hallucination, or maybe some would say a kind of psychic phenomena, a ghost. But once again, this line of thought, though it's often been argued, doesn't fit the facts. For we're told explicitly that a hallucination and a ghost was exactly what the early disciples thought they were seeing at first. They said the women were delirious, that they were seeing imaginary things when they brought back the news of the resurrection. And they said they thought they had seen a ghost when they first saw Jesus risen from the dead too. But the point was, he wasn't. He convinced them he wasn't. He convinced them he was a physical person. All right, with supernatural properties. He was able to appear and disappear at will, it seems. But he was not intangible. He wasn't a figment of their imagination anywhere. He wasn't a ghostly projection. In fact, 2 pieces of concrete evidence rule out this talk of ghosts and hallucinations. The first is the evidence of the empty tomb. There is no way the story of the resurrection could have gained credence unless that tomb was empty. If it hadn't been empty, the Jewish authorities would have exposed the whole thing as a fantasy and scotched the rumour of it before it began anywhere. And if it hadn't been empty, there were hundreds and hundreds of people in the immediate vicinity of Jerusalem who could have dismissed the story for themselves by just going along and proving that the tomb was still there. But on the day of Pentecost, just a few weeks after Easter, you don't find 3,000 skeptics responding to Peter's sermon by saying, no, Jesus isn't risen from the dead, he's still lying there in the tomb, we know where the tomb is. Instead, you find 3,000 people converted to Christianity, convinced they are right when they say Jesus is risen from the dead. For it was common knowledge in Jerusalem. The second piece of evidence, I think, that scotches all this talk of ghosts and hallucinations is the psychological evidence of the disciples' confusion. See, we don't find the early Christians leaping to the conclusion that Jesus was alive readily. We find, in fact, shock and puzzlement, and even a measure of reluctance to believe it. We find people saying, we really hoped it was true. And now someone's come and told us that Jesus is alive, and we're really confused. We're struggling between hope and despair. Even when Jesus met them, there were some, we're told, who for whom the penny just didn't drop immediately, and who found it an extremely difficult thing to accept. Well, that's what you would expect, isn't it? But the pattern of hallucinatory experiences is quite different. The whole point of hallucinations in the post-bereavement period is that the person who experiences them is the victim of some kind of wish fulfillment. They're only too glad to accept the assurance that the lost one is still alive. What we find with the disciples is that they were bewildered, they were surprised, they were amazed. And that's just the sort of emotional response you would expect from sane, well-balanced people who really did encounter somebody risen from the dead. They didn't want it to happen. They weren't wishing for it to happen. They weren't expecting it to happen. But it broke in upon them. Now, I suggest to you that all these alternative explanations, of course, can be argued. But when you really look at the evidence, they don't fit very well. You maybe can persuade yourself they are possible explanations, but you have to discreetly overlook the awkwardness of the evidence to the contrary to do that. A bit like the professors of Padua, who wouldn't look down the telescope and really face up to the moons of Jupiter going round Jupiter. And I say again, that isn't being scientific. That's being the very opposite. It's confusing science with what in fact is much closer to prejudice. Now, I suggest to you this Easter, if you've never done so before, it's a good opportunity to look at the story of Jesus' resurrection afresh. If you don't believe it happened, if you have some other explanation of what happened, well, read the gospel accounts, read this little book, The Evidence of the Resurrection, see if it really holds water, your theory. But do beware of that kind of a priori exclusion, which is tacitly saying, well, God, I don't believe in you, I don't want to believe in you, and I don't intend to give you the opportunity to prove me wrong about that. Because if that's what's really going on inside of us, we have a vested interest in proving the resurrection didn't happen, because we don't really want to face up to whatever the implications would be for our lives if the resurrection were true, then we're never going to find faith. We will always miss out on faith. Not because the evidence isn't there. We may pretend it's because the evidence isn't there, but that won't be the real reason, will it? The reason we won't find faith is because we don't want to find faith.